Hello, I'm Cara Dahl Russell. Last Wednesday afternoon, I was able to catch up with a performer that will be part of the Chesapeake Chamber Music Festival. This is the 28th annual Chamber Music Festival. It runs from Sunday, June 2nd through Sunday, June 16th. And Anthony Manzo will be playing the double bass on three of the events in the second week, and I'm very happy to be able to speak to him now. Hi, Anthony.
Hello.
He will be playing as part of the Dynamic Duos program on Thursday, June 13th, that will be held at the Easton Studio and School in Easton. I'm so glad to be able to talk to you.
I'm glad to be here.
I'm going to rattle through some of your credentials that I was able to get offline, that you've played with the National Symphony Orchestra, the Munich Chamber Orchestra, the Smithsonian Chamber Orchestra. Any other names you want to throw at us as to where you've performed and who you performed with?
I also play with the New Century Chamber Orchestra in San Francisco. Yeah, that's probably a fair representation.
That's a good cross-section. And you play the double bass.
I do.
Which is one of the reasons I want to talk to you. I haven't yet interviewed a double bassist, and those of us who play the large instruments, I play the harp, you know, we're usually the two biggest on biggest pieces of furniture being brought on to be played.
Those of us that drive big cars.
Yes, exactly. So I guess I should start there. Do you ever wish that you played the piccolo?
Well, if I did, I'd have to carry two instruments around. Certainly I wouldn't be honest if I said there weren't times that I wish I didn't have to carry the instrument around, or whenever I travel by airplane, and that's always often quite a nightmare. But in terms of actually playing the instrument, no, I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Did you begin on the bass, or did you have a transitional period as you were a beginning student?
Essentially, I started on the bass. My first instrument actually was the flute when I was very little, but after 5 days, my teacher told me my hands were too small, and I said switch to the clarinet. And actually, that was because he was the local band director and needed clarinets in his band, not flutes. And I actually hated the clarinet for all the time that I played it, and I'll never admit how long I took lessons, and eventually quit. And many years later, started playing the bass, which I was in love with from the very beginning.
You don't usually hear the combination of your hands are too small and then playing the bass.
I'm not sure if there was some spite happening there when I chose the bass, but whatever it is, it seems to have worked out.
You have a very particular instrument. I would love it if you would wax poetic about the instrument that you play.
I'm very lucky to have found a French instrument made by Jérôme Thibouville-Lamy in about 1890. The instrument was actually made for a instrument maker's competition at the turn of the century. And so in addition to using some very ideal wood that usually would have been saved for violins or things like that, you could probably make 7 or 8 violins out of, if not more, out of the wood you would use for a double bass. So usually the finest woods go to smaller instruments like that. But for this particular competition, the maker chose some really beautiful woods and then also spent a lot more time on the aesthetics of the instrument. So it has a lion's head scroll and lots of figuration on the back and in the purfling. And that's really a beautiful instrument, and I'm very happy and very lucky to have it.
Yes, that does sound like a dream instrument. I did read it now has a removable neck for travel.
Yes, it does. After a mishap while I was traveling, coming back from a chamber music concert out in California, the neck of the instrument was snapped off during the flight. And when I had it put back together, I actually had it done with a removable neck, which is Luthier in Montreal was making. And so now whenever I fly with it, I take it apart and it fits into a case that's about the size of the body of the instrument. It's a much smaller package and much easier to travel with, though it's still large, it's still oversized, and still causes lots of trouble. It's significantly less. It also means that I can fit on smaller airplanes for a lot of the smaller chamber music festivals and things like that. It makes it a lot simpler to get to where I need to be.
Does that affect the value of the instrument at all?
It certainly did have an effect on it. I won't know until I end up selling the instrument toward the end of my career. But in some ways, improved its practicality for me.
It's, yes.
But as to the actual result of how much, what the actual monetary value will be, it probably did affect it some.
It's so hard to know that. Anyway, if I could, I'd like to spend a little time just on some of the logistical, technical aspects of the instrument, as most of our listeners will have attended symphonies and seen over time, I'd say over the past at least 15 years, if not longer, it's not uncommon to see a bass that has additional strings on one side of the fingerboard, and as well as some elongated strings. What is that?
Basically, the double bass was never really standardized until the late 19th century, and even then, there's a lot more variation in the body of the instrument and the setup of the instrument than there is with any other string instrument. But the general pattern now is an instrument tuned in fourths, with the low string being E, and then A, D, and G is the top string. And often what you'll see now is an addition to the instrument in one way or another that allows that low E string to go down to a low C, so it can actually be the same, can be exactly one octave lower than the lowest string of the cello, so that when we double cello parts, we can actually go all the way down to an octave below their lowest notes. So there are basically two ways that that's usually done. In Europe, most of the time what you see is five-string double basses, so there's an entire extra string added at the bottom of the instrument, usually a low B string or sometimes tuned into a C.
And is that sometimes why the fingerboard extends farther on the right, so you can go higher to match the cello better?
Actually, that's the other version of how we get those low notes, and that's using an extension, which is much more common in the United States and in England, which is basically an extension of the fingerboard at the top of the instrument, going up over the scroll, and that extends that E string, actually physically makes it longer, so it extends it down to a low C. Then we actually just reach back and finger the notes at the top of the on this extension of the fingerboard, which is, it's actually what I have on my instrument. I have a four-string bass, but I have an extension of the E string that goes back over my scroll, and actually, in my case, over the lion's head, and in order to play those low notes.
And now, of course, there are the electronic basses. Some people call them practice basses, but I've also seen them played in various forms, as well as the carbon fiber instruments. Have any particular thoughts on them?
Oh, they're great for their uses. The practice instruments, or the stick basses, they're often called, simplify one's traveling life immensely if you don't have to drag the big beast around. And when you put a pickup on it and your sound is being created through the electronics, it's quite functional for what it is. It'll never have the resonance or the particular sound of an acoustic bass, but if you have to travel with it, life's a lot easier. And the carbon fiber instruments are certainly an interesting recent development, and I have yet to play a carbon fiber instrument that blew me away. However, I have played a few that certainly are serviceable, and in many situations, if you had to play outside or for students that would knock them around quite a lot, I could certainly see they have their use, and I think that those instruments are just going to continue to improve as the technology.
I know that I'm aware, and just in the past 7 years, their price has raised in about an eighth. So the prices are rising. I'm assuming that means a rise in their popularity. I'm wondering whether one would ever really see them in a symphony. There is a tonal quality difference, I think.
Mm-hmm. At this point, I haven't seen them very often. I've actually never a double bass, but I've seen a couple of cellos, actually, carbon fiber cellos that were used by people in symphony orchestras, but mostly for like an outdoor concert or something like that, where it's not absolutely critical to the quality of the sound. And
the projection would help. Yeah.
Right. But I'd be curious to see what happens in the years to come. Certainly the technology is greatly increased. The first carbon fiber instruments I ever saw were a joke, basically. And in a few short years, I've heard a number now that have been quite serviceable, not great instruments, not what I would choose to play chamber music, but something you could certainly get away with in many situations.
Well, and they're certainly lighter. I know. I actually sat down at a carbon fiber harp and almost threw it across the room as I was pulling it back to my shoulder because they're that much lighter. Why don't you tell me a little bit about the program that you're going to be playing? You know, you're playing on Thursday, June 13th, I understand.
Yes, that's correct.
As part of Marcy Rosen and Friends. Marcy Rosen is one of the founders of the Chesapeake Chamber Music Festival. What works will you be playing?
I will be doing the Rossini duo for cello and bass, which probably fit quite well into the dynamic duo idea. Should be great fun. The piece was written as a commission by David Salomons, who was a amateur cellist and very wealthy impresario in London. And he commissioned Rossini to write a piece for himself and for a very famous double bassist named Domenico Dragonetti, who's one of the great virtuosos of the instrument, and who was living in London at the time. The exact conditions of the first performances are not really exactly known, but it's very likely it was most likely at a private party, private soiree, and could even happen there at the party. And certainly it was written very quickly and with a minimum of exactness of notation like that. It's there are many things that were clearly left to the performers. And
kind of a sketch.
Yeah, it's basically, and ends up being just a lot of fun, a lot of improvisation, a bit of a game of tag, if you will, at times with the cellist doing something and the bassist trying to follow along. Or in this case, it was probably would have been interesting to hear the first performance with a good amateur cellist, but also followed by one of the greatest double bass virtuosos that ever lived. So a lot of the playing around and sort of one-upsmanship was probably quite dramatic in that situation. And so it leaves lots of room for embellishment and for playing around and adding things. It should be a lot of fun. It always is every time I do it. My wife is actually a cellist, so I've done it many, many times.
Oh, nice.
And I'm very much looking forward to doing it with Marcy. It should be a lot of fun.
It does sound fun and interesting. I confess I love the cello and the bass. I love the low voices of the string section. I like a lot of instruments, but they're a particular favorite. It's very unusual to hear the bass singled out and pulled out, which is probably one of the reasons I enjoy it when I get to hear it. Now, one of the features of being a double bassist is that you have more opportunity to cross over into other kinds of music. Do you take advantage of that?
Fortunately, far less than I would ideally like. I mostly play, or at least perform, classical music, though I do certainly a great range of the classical music. I do a lot of chamber music. I play with many orchestras all over the place, and do a lot of chamber orchestra playing, especially. As for genres beyond that, jazz I love, but I've never performed publicly. I've done it for fun for myself. And years ago, when I lived in Munich, I used to play with a gypsy band a little bit, which was
not always the most challenging music for the bassist.
Actually, some of it, certainly a lot of the gypsy stuff was in wacky odd meters and things like that. So the first time I was trying to improvise in 11/16, my eyes were crossing and all that until I finally just let go and let it happen. And then it was great
fun. Oh, that's
fun.
Good. We usually hear of that, like the bass and the tuba usually have the boom, 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 same thing over and over through the whole piece. So that's good to know there is a variety. Now, I did read that you also perform period music. Do you do that on your bass, or do you have a different instrument?
I have another bass that's set up specifically for period playing.
How does it differ?
The most obvious is it uses gut strings all the way across, and then the setup of the angle of the neck is much shallower, and I use a host of different bows with it, depending on what era of music and what the demands of the repertoire are.
Now, is that a bass viol, or is it still a double bass?
That's actually an interesting question. It's not really well defined. What I play is actually a Baroque bass. There are other instruments, violone, which was often used in the period situations, but that depended a lot on what country you were in or what era. And a lot of the same music would have actually been performed on different instruments, on violone in bass viol and in France, or a bass violon, so there was a lot of crossover as to what exactly was played. So mostly what I try to do is follow the sound that's created is something that reflects what would have been appropriate for the time.
Great. I appreciate that. I know some people don't understand that there was a transitional period where probably the current bass and the bass viol and the Baroque bass were probably all being played, and it just depends where you, as you said, where you were and what the music was written for. Sometimes it was specified and sometimes it wasn't. What are the biggest misperceptions or perceptions of the bass, either things that you feel you need to elaborate on or to counter when people have ideas of what the bass, the double bass is?
Well, probably the most common one is the whenever I'm walking down the street or someone sees the instrument, they immediately start going boom, 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 which is true. That is a significant part of what we do. But the bass at the same time can be quite vocal, quite eloquent, and quite virtuosic. Actually, my favorite role is to play a supporting role in one way or another. Certainly there's a versatility to the instrument, which is generally not known or seen. Actually, this these concerts at Chesapeake Chamber Music Festival should be a great example of the whole range of what the bass can do. With the Rossini duo, we should be quite virtuosic and challenging, and then a lot of the other things I'm doing are basso continuo, so very much playing a supporting role, but often in a quite dramatic and manner.
That was something that I found interesting on one of your online interviews, as you said that you really like the supporting role in the orchestra and you feel like it gives you a freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. For me, that's time. I'm not sure if it's, I've always sort of wondered if it's because of instrument or because of the nature of my personality or some combination of both. They certainly both influence each other, but I find myself very much, my ideal role is not the one in the spotlight at the front of the stage. It's in a supporting role, in the collaborative role. It's where I enjoy myself the most. So I love playing basso continuo. I love being the foundation in which everything is built upon, and giving, and the freedom and flexibility that brings, and how much you can actually be in control or influence a performance from the bottom, steering things, giving rhythmic impulses that really set the tone for everything that happens, but not necessarily what's under the spotlight. I suppose one of my most enjoyable situations I ever had was a couple of years ago, I had the great pleasure of performing with Thomas Kwasthoff on a tour in Europe, in which we were doing Mozart's aria Per questa bella mano, which is an aria for bass baritone and double bass obbligato. And many times that I've stood in front of the orchestra as a soloist, it's never been something that I've been really drawn to. But to stand up in front of the orchestra with another artist like that, where what we were doing was completely collaborative, and we just had such fun in the front of the stage, and it was the most fun I ever had in a soloist role, and it was mostly because it was not about being a soloist, it was about being interactive with someone on the stage, on the front of the stage.
That's marvelous to hear. It also, interestingly, dovetails with a previous interview I did with an oboist who's very much a spotlight performer, mm-hmm. who he didn't really understand why people wanted to work in orchestras. And I do think that's an essential part of it, is different people enjoy the collaborative more and other people enjoy the spotlight more.
Uh-huh.
And so there are definitely assets to both of them. And I think part of the job of a professional musician is finding out that dynamic of where you want to be in the whole range of what's offered to you, but also in where you feel is the best fit for you personally.
Absolutely, and that can be quite a challenge, and also something that will change over time at different points in one's career. And I feel very lucky to have been very much in the collaborative world, where I felt comfortable through a large part of my career.
Speaking of career, you have a day job at the University of Maryland College Park, teaching at the School of Music. Are you teaching solo bass? Are you teaching other things?
I have several private students there, and then I collaborate with two other professors there, teaching double bass repertoire class and also the studio classes, where all the basses come together once a week and perform something, get coachings from us.
That sounds like fun.
It can be quite fun. In addition, I'm also on chamber music faculty and do a bit of chamber music coaching of all different stripes, which is one of the things I enjoy most.
I like to ask people about your own experience with teachers, the good, the ugly, the in-between. What is your history with various teachers? And since you're teaching now, what did you pick up as to what to do and what not to do?
I was very lucky to have ended up with my primary teacher where I studied in Boston at Boston University as Jim Orleans. He's a double bassist with the Boston Symphony. For me, was ended up just being the ideal teacher, and the large part is, in addition to being a fantastic player and an incredible musician himself, he's also very, very open and encouraged me in every way to get all the input and influences I could from every bass player, every musician I could come in contact with, and to find what worked for me. He was one who was definitely not interested in molding his students in his image. He wanted them to maximize what they had, to the point of we would, in lessons, he would suddenly say, "Hey, you know, the Ed Barker, the principal bass of the in Boston, does this really well. Why don't you go take a lesson with him next week?" And a couple of weeks later, be someone else or working on something else. And that's something that I've very much brought into my own teaching as well. I look for students who are independent and like to challenge themselves, and that I can guide, but not someone who is expecting all the answers from me. I find a lot of what I end up doing in lessons is asking questions and letting the students find the answers that work for them. That to me also is what makes music or any endeavor really enjoyable, is when it's a continuing exploration. It can always be different and always new, and there's recognizing there's many, many different ways to accomplish anything, and the value in exploring all of the possibilities.
How do you prepare your students for sometimes ephemeral at worst and wacky at best life of being a performing musician? What do you think you weren't aware of?
Yeah, it's definitely, certainly in the classical world, it's a very, very competitive, challenging way to make a career and to make a living. And it can be very enjoyable and quite rewarding, but there's an incredibly small number of positions which one can really make a living.
Yes.
And quite a challenge.
Do you feel that you can address that with your students without being accused of suppressing their hopes?
It's interesting. I find one of the things that is most important to me is that making music is something that one has to be passionate about to have it be worthwhile to make a career of. And if that's not there, then there's lots of other things that one can do, and that will be probably more rewarding in the long run. But a career in music without a passion for it is would be a very unfortunate thing. So I do a lot of certainly encouraging my students and them to work really, really hard toward what they want, but also having them recognize that music is a language, and that it's a way of expressing something. And fluency in the language is just the beginning. Once you gain that fluency, then you have to have something to say. So being completely focused on nothing but music, on the mechanics of playing an instrument, is not going to be a fulfilling thing in the end. And that I always encourage my students to explore other things, other endeavors, other academic things, anything that interests them, really, because those are the things that you bring to music, and so that you have something to express. In the process of doing that, many of them have also ended up finding other things that they love, or that eventually became more important to them than playing the double bass is their primary thing, and that's fine, that's great. But most importantly, they've kept that, recognize that there's something they love and can enjoy and can always be a part of what they do, but doesn't have to be the. And the ones that stick with it through that have a lot more to bring to their music making and have a lot more to say. And those are the kinds of musicians that I like to listen to myself. So anything I do to encourage those sorts of musicians to come to the fore, then I will certainly do that.
Well, thank you so much for the time you spent talking with us. I've been speaking with double bassist Anthony Manzo, who teaches at the University of Maryland College Park School of Music and has an extensive ongoing chamber music and orchestral career. He's appearing here on the Delmarva Peninsula as part of the 28th annual Chesapeake Chamber Music Festival. You can find out more about the three dates that he's playing, as well as the many other talented musicians, at their website, chesapeakechambermusic.org. that runs Sunday, June 2nd through June 16th, a wide variety of musical events, and that directed by J. Laurie Bloom and Marcy Rosen, whom you'll be playing with. Thanks for taking the time to tell us a little bit about the instrument that you love. Thank you very much, Tony.
It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to being out on the Eastern Shore.